Welcome to Little Atoms on Resonance 104.4 FM, a live talk show based around ideas of the Enlightenment.
Little Atoms is presented by Neil Denny, Padraig Reedy, Richard Saunderson, and Rebecca Watson, as well as regular mystery guest presenters.
Little Atoms makes no claims to balance. We actively promote science, freedom of expression, skepticism, and secular humanism. This means we can often end up talking about superstition, religious fundamentalism, censorship, and conspiracy theory.
Our guests bring ideas that are challenging, sometimes controversial, often polemical, but always interesting. Welcome to Little Atoms. This week with me, Neil Denny, and with Richard Saunderson. And Richard's about to introduce David Stubbs, our guest for the evening.
Thank you. This is something of a busman's holiday for me because I rarely get to discuss music on Little Atoms. I think the last time was with Marcus de Sortoy, the mathematician, where we talked about Xenarchus for about a minute. It should be a bit longer than a minute today. We'll be talking to David Stubbs. David is a freelance British music journalist and author. Between 2004 and 2006, he was the reviews editor for The Wire, the UK-based magazine dedicated to avant-garde and experimental music of all genre. Between 1987 and 1998, he was staff writer at Melody Maker before going on to join the staff of the NME. As well as music, he also covers sport, film, literature and TV. His work regularly appears in The Guardian, Arena, The Wire, Uncut and When Saturday Comes. Tonight we'll be talking about David's book, which is called Fear of Music, Why People Get Rothko But Don't Get Stockhausen. And I like the use of the term get there a lot. Ooh, David, yeah. And welcome to Little Atoms. I'd like to start first of all with, you talk about Tony Hancock's film, The Rebel.
Indeed.
And there's a moment in that film which kind of encapsulates everything that you're talking about in the book. And I wonder if you could just describe that moment for us as a starting point of the discussion.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, he's Tony Hancock plays himself, you know, as this kind of this artist. He claims to be eventually of the infantile school of art, and the whole thing is obviously a kind of slightly crude send up of modern art in itself. But yes, he ends up in Paris and ends up being lionized by all these various people. He ends up at this kind of rather rich Parisian patron's house, and at one point he's wandering around this kind of vast hallway, and he looks up and he sees what's clearly a sort of piece of abstract expressionist art in the Jackson Pollock vein. And he just says, "Who's on raving mad here then?" and then he attempts one of his own, you know, where he just sort of splashes around randomly on a big sheet on the floor in his studio, and then he gets on a bike, and then it's worth 2,000 quid if anybody's money that. And the idea is that, like, the joke isn't really, I mean, the joke extends on the art, but the joke even then, and this is about 1960, 61, that sort of time, the joke is on him for not getting abstract expressionism. And so even at that point, you know, that kind of art, which is, you know, still considered, you know, which I think is, in a sense, difficult, experimental art, was something that had registered with people and, you know, was considered kind of acceptable and credible. But around about that time, Stockhausen, Karlheinz Stockhausen, would have recorded Contactor, I think, in about 1960. And some 50 years on, I think, you play that to people, who, even people that were very well acquainted with abstract experimental art, that kind of thing. You pull it to them, and it's just like, who's gone raving mad here then?
Indeed, Stockhausen, who, you know, is very much a touchstone for what we're talking about. And I was wondering why you actually chose him as instead of perhaps, say, somebody like Morton Feldman, who actually did music that was, you know, he was a friend of Rothko and even wrote music to play in the Rothko Chapel. And yet, and he's also pretty much unknown, I would say.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose someone like Morton Feldman, he is an example of somebody who did actually have a kind of strong friendship with someone like Mark Rothko or whatever. So he is, as it were, really the counterpart to someone like him, and he did the Rothko Chapel as well. But Stockhausen, I suppose, is, as it were, he has this kind of dimension of infamy about him. And when he, throughout his life, you know, when people want to sort of have sort of, you know, sort of cheap joke, avant-garde music, whatever. Stockhausen would be the one that would refer
Thomas
to.
Thomas Beecham comes to mind. With yes. His, I trod in some.
Yes. You know, that sort of license for listenism, you know, which I would never do, you know, for, you know, the art equivalent.
Can we, before we move on, let's sort of define what we're actually talking about. And obviously, you know, you guys know, and Resonance FM listeners will know, but perhaps for the wider audience, when we're talking about sort of avant-garde music, what do you mean? Because, I mean, you're talking about Stockhausen, which is, it's a tautology, obviously, but is sort of like modern classical music. But what else? Because the book is about a much wider range of music than that.
Well, it takes its starting point, really, around about, the first decade of the 20th century. So I think that something like Les Demoiselles d'Avignon by Picasso is commonly accepted to be the first piece of modern art insofar as it departs, it's non-figurative. Mm-hmm. Around about the same time, people like Schoenberg are departing from the sort of principles of tonality that have governed classical music for centuries. And so in a sense, you know, contemporary experimental art and contemporary experimental music, you still call them contemporary about 100 years on, both sort of derive from the same root. And very early on, there was this sense that they were kind of just thinking in a very, very sort of strong parallel terms. And Schoenberg and Kandinsky had this correspondence, this very excited correspondence, because both, I mean, Schoenberg was a bit of a painter on the side and Kandinsky was a bit of a musician, and they thought they were kind of at the point of approaching some sort of synesthesia, you know, that they could actually, that somehow or other sort of art and music were kind of, you know, working in such kind of congruent ways that they were somehow going to merge and create this kind of new sort of super hybrid form, but unfortunately fell out.
Which is often the tale with a lot of avant-garde people, isn't it? They fall out.
Yeah, yes.
But that's sort of, that falling out is almost symbolic in the book, isn't it? Because that's sort of the point where, you know, you use that to illustrate how the two forms.
Yeah, I mean, it was coincidental. I mean, they fell out over perceived sort of anti-Semitic slight on Kandinsky's part, et cetera, et cetera. And it just never quite happened. But, I mean, obviously the real reasons why eventually a kind of schism, as there was a contrast of fate, there were various reasons.
And clearly the artists, you mentioned Kandinsky and Schoenberg there, they clearly thought that they were sort of pushing the boundaries a bit and saw some sort of connection between what they were doing. But is this a parallel that runs throughout modern art and modern music, that the musicians and artists saw themselves both sort of working parallel?
I think at various times they definitely have been. I mean, I don't think, in terms of the artists themselves, I don't think the artists have necessarily sort of grown apart. And I mean, you know, you mentioned sort of various sort of little pairings that have like occurred, like Morton Feldman and Rothko. I mean, John Cage mates with Robert Rauschenberg. And then nowadays you've got a lot of people who kind of work between the two, and you've got like people like Mike Kelly and people who work in both. And Mayor Thompson of Red Crayola, who works in both music and also in visual arts. So, you know, I think there is still that kind of Kandinsky-Schoenberg spirit, but I suppose what has happened is to say there's been this contrast in fate. Basically, you've got this high end in the visual arts where, you know, take something like Tate Modern, which is it's not only one of the most, you know, it's one of the most popular tourist attractions in Europe, you know, any kind, you know. So clearly people are dedicated to nothing but sort of non-figurative, experimental, avant-garde visual art. And, you know, and you see constantly there are stories in the papers about, you know, works by sort of Bacon or Pollock or Rothko selling for absolutely millions, you know, millions upon millions upon millions. So you've got this kind of high end there, and then you've got, as it were, the sort of low end sort of suffered by people working in kind of like areas like improv, avant-garde, classical, or whatever.
Exactly, and you mentioned the fact that
gets no exposure, is considered still kind of very ridiculous and very strange in the work of madmen and women, you know.
And you mentioned the fact that in the Tate Modern shop there's about 10 CDs. You would have thought, well, here's the absolute place where one should be able to go and buy a Cecil Taylor CD or a Derek Bailey or whatever.
Let's talk again about let's look at some of the practitioners of the avant-garde music scene then, because we'll talk about in the second half of the show, we'll go into the reasons why music and art have been taken up so differently. But let's talk about some more of the people, the characters and the bands that we're actually referring to.
Well, for me, I mean, it's kind of quite free-ranging in terms of the sort of music that I refer to. It isn't just classical music.
No, exactly.
But certainly, I mean, certainly in classical music, there was a sort of hiatus, really, because I think that Schoenberg, and that was kind of very exciting, the departure from tonality, etc. And then you had like Luigi Russolo, the futurist, who wrote, you know, the Art of Noises, and he created these kind of noise intonators, as he called them, that made these weird series of threeps and noises. And he was attempting to, you know, he was trying to introduce the concept of noise, in, you know, usher in from the outside, collapse the walls between, as it were, the outside world of like backfiring engines and whatever, and things like that, and say that, no, this is actually part of the realm of art now.
But again, but you've already raised that point that's sort of indivisible from the Futurist manifesto itself, isn't it? People, you know, the Futurist painters who were painting, you know, sort of industrial scenes and the machine. So those two things are still quite closely linked at that point. Yeah.
But I suppose for me that there is this section over the next 20 years when I suppose modern art sort of races ahead, you know, with people like, you know, goes from the Dadaists, then you've got the Surrealists and things like that, and Surrealists, you know, people like Dali becoming these sort of superstar artists. And
we're just playing a piece of, of avant-garde music just here. Music,
yes.
I'm not sure who this one actually is. It sounds
indeed,
quite
yes.
Chamber-y.
Yes, there you go. There you are. No, sorry about that. But so in the 20s, I mean, you've got nascent forms like jazz that are coming through, and Duke Ellington, who himself is considered to be pretty dissonant at the time, but obviously isn't really, you know, by contemporary standards. And in fact, really, with music, it's only in about the sort of after the war, when there's developments in technological developments and introduction of magnetic tape and things like that, and also the possibility of creating kind of pure electronic works, that you get people like Pierre Schaeffer and Stockhausen. But at that point, the whole locus of like contemporary art of all kinds of music has shifted away from Europe to America. And so it's all kind of happening on the wrong continent then, you know, for the musicians. And so, you know, you're probably better off being John Cage in a sense, you know, working over in America, except that, I mean, although his work in a sense, although he creates music, it's sometimes, you know, it's a moot point as to whether it's kind of music in the sense. It's almost like planned events, really, with John Cage. You know, he hated improvisers. You know, it is music that is almost like, you know, it's sound art, really. Mm-hmm.
It's crossing over to philosophy as well, Cage, isn't it?
Yeah. And I suppose, meanwhile, then, you've got in the 50s, obviously, jazz is rapidly kind of evolving over the course of, say, 80 years, the extent that it took, you know, from like Buddy Bolden, who we were talking about earlier on. And then music, it rapidly evolved into the point where it's almost like got a sort of parity with the sort of point of classical music, you know, almost a point of abstraction. You know, people like Charlie Parker and things like that, and then eventually Ornette Coleman. And, you know, and I suppose that's the kind of music tradition. And then, of course, rock music, you know, rock and roll comes along and it goes on its own sort of little trajectory, and then rock has its own avant-garde, you know. And so, those are the kind of various little developments. And the kind of various, and then free jazz creates this kind of like breakaway improv scene in which the fusion of classical music. You've got people like A&M, you've got Sun Ra, people like that in jazz, suddenly kind of using electronics, which is a first. And then in the 70s, you've got Cabaret Voltaire and people like that and Throbbing Gristle that are kind of taking rock music into a kind of, into a realm, that, you know, into this kind of realms of abstraction, experimentalism, you know, and industrial and things like that. Each of these sort of genres, you know, and eventually there's a kind of fusion of all of the lot of them, you know.
Should we, we're about halfway, so I'll say we listen to Little Atoms with me, Neil Denny and Richard Sanderson, and we're talking to David Stubbs about his book Fear of Music, Why People Get Rothko But Don't Get Stockhausen. So, well, let's move on and talk then about some of the reasons why modern art and avant-garde music have taken such divergent paths then. I mean, let's talk about the reasons why. Well, starting off with art, you mentioned like Tate Modern being a huge tourist destination these days. I mean, this is something that often comes up. Jonathan Meads has been on the show numerous times, and, you know, one of his themes is this idea that something like Tate Modern or like the Guggenheim in Bilbao are like sort of signature buildings that revive an area, but then there's actually buildings that people go to because they're nice buildings, but there's not actually that much stuff to put in them at the end of the day because there is so many of these. I mean, I suppose that's part of modern art becoming incredibly popular. You know, even though there might not be that much stuff in these things, it's still, there's a reason why people are flocking to them.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that cathedral point. I noticed that next time I went to the Museum of Modern Art, actually, that there seemed to be kind of, when they sort of redesigned it, there seemed to be a greater stress on the building itself.
Yeah, that's
right. And the sense of the shrine, the cathedral, and people flocking there than there was actual content.
And it is almost like a modern cathedral in that people are going in because they feel that they're going to be in some way sort of uplifted or spiritually changed by just being in the presence of an artwork.
Being present. And it goes back to what's kind of like the aura that is associated with art, which I think is, it has kind of an economical thing and as well in the, you know, and Walter Benjamin talks about you know, reproduction in the original, and it's, you know, the word is actually auratic, that there is this sort of quality that people, sometimes. I mean, people talk about this, like John Carey wrote a book called What Good Are the Arts? I think he tried to look into this very closely, and he was kind of hammered for it. He was accused of philistinism, in a sense. But I think he was kind of raising an interesting point that, and I think there is sort of tremendous things to be derived from, you know, to go into art galleries, things like that. But I sometimes think people are looking for things that are rather spurious. They're perhaps looking for some sort of elevation, or they think that somehow art rays will transmit from something like the Mona Lisa or Jackson Pollock. And if you stand in proximity to these things, that these things are almost like magical properties, and that they'll be, you know, in some way sort of spiritually uplifted or transformed or elevated. And for me, you know, that is completely spurious. I mean, people do the same thing with music, perhaps, in some sort of small way. But I think but I suppose what's less appealing from music, of course, music is mainly reproduction, certainly in the form of CDs and things like that. You have the live event, for sure, which, again, sometimes people venerate to a certain extent. But you can't attach the same sort of price tag to, say, musical creations or experimental musical creations than you can to, say, I don't know, a Jackson Pollock or a Francis Bacon. And I think that people are actually quite avaricious at heart. And I think that, you know, these stories over the sort of years, I mean, you know, that once these sorts of works of art started to command very high sums, that suddenly, you know, that becomes a sort of source of fascination in itself. That, you know, the story about it then appears, you know, with a little kind of image of the artwork in question. You know, the artist themselves suddenly becomes very wealthy and therefore becomes iconic and a celebrity in their own right or whatever. And I think that kind of draws attention. It also gets people used to the concept of experimental visual art, and therefore people are less fazed by it. As well as also abstract art actually having a kind of decorative thing, whereas music doesn't have that equivalent of the original. It doesn't have that kind of its sort of economy. And music like Stockhausen is invasive.
I suppose the other obvious point that people would make is that you have to spend time with music, unless it's a sort of 30-second jingle. So if we're talking about a piece by Stockhausen, then, you know, some of them go on for hours. Whereas you can kind of do a Rothko in 5 minutes.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. And also, a Rothko, even though Rothko is a really, he's almost like cheating, you know, in the Rothko room at the Tate Modern with the lights and, you know, like dim lights and whatever, and trying to create an atmosphere that's hard to escape from. Well, you actually can escape from it, you know, within a few minutes. And also, it takes place within your kind of field of vision. And so, yeah, it's not, I mean, it's almost an attempt to create a sort of ambience, but, you know, inherently a painting can't do that, you know. And you can be in and out of there in 10 minutes. Now, the Stockhausen, a piece like Hymnen, which lasts 100 minutes, if you leave after 10 minutes, you've basically admitted defeat.
This kind of discussion inevitably lends towards anecdotes, but it does remind me when I worked in a record shop and somebody wanted to hear some of Miles Davis's electric stuff. And I think I chose Jack Johnson or something for him to listen to, because he'd not heard anything like it before. And he put it on and listened to it for about 10 seconds and went click straight onto the next track, click straight onto the next track. And I just thought, well, you're not going to get it from that.
No, absolutely, no. I mean, people it's not that people just reject instantly. I mean, there isn't really much kind of discourse on this kind of stuff, because it just didn't get anywhere near people, mostly, or when it does get near people swat it away pretty much instantaneously, you know. Therefore, there is very little awareness and very little experience of actually how to absorb these things.
Well, you're saying that, you know, Richard's just talking about somebody not getting Miles Davis, and of course, you know, this book is subtitled Why People Get Rothko But Don't Get Stockhausen, as Richard highlighted at the beginning. Yet right at the end of the book, there's a story about Ornette Coleman basically saying that people come up to him and say, you know, I really enjoyed that, but I don't understand it, and him being sort of a bit taken aback by the fact that people need to get music.
That is the problem, yeah. That's what you get. There's nothing to get. People think that you have to kind of, that it's like a cryptic crossword or something like that, that all of this music represents some sort of like complex algebraic formula where the answer is pi or something like that, and it's not like that. You know, that they feel like that, and that in a sense is making the mistake that eventually somehow you have to kind of rationalize this music, and what you have to get is that you don't do that. You experience it, you absorb it. You know, you don't need to be that bright. And that's one of the things that helps in my case. It really isn't that. It's a case, but what you do have to be is very, very open minded, prepared to sort of like have this kind of complex field of events, and you know what that in a sense reflects about the world, about experience, about aesthetics.
But if something's like, if you're going to see something that you're not familiar with, something that's quite challenging, music's quite, you know, it's not in the same way as art, it's invasive in that, you know, it's not something you can escape from. If you don't like a picture, you can close your eyes. I mean, you can't really block your ears if you're experiencing that. If you're not sitting there because you think somehow I'm putting up with this because I know it's somehow edifying. I know this is somehow making me a better person. So what is the
point? Well, of course, it's very difficult. I mean, obviously, people that are it's not going to be for everybody. And I mean, I do talk about the idea that the 1920s and 30s, there was an attempt on the Radio Times as part, the BBC, and then reflecting the Radio Times to try and get people listening to things like Weber and Schoenberg, and they would have these special presentations at the end of the day. And I have to say, frankly, I have a pang of sympathy. You know, we're very didactic about it. And they have little editorials in the Radio Times, and they're saying, now see
it. Tells you how
you're really not
it,
listening properly. You know, you really ought to learn to listen harder to this stuff. And it's just like, you know, frankly, the poor sods that had to live through the 20s and 30s. It was rough enough getting through the 30s without necessarily having to be sort of put through these kind of challenges. And I love Webern, you know, but, you know, I do understand that. And I think, obviously, you have to be careful in the way that you kind of browbeat people. And I think, you know, obviously, people have to want to sort of, these things have to be, you know, you have to find ways that aren't quite so sort of didactic. But, yeah, I mean, but the thing is, you know, the positives, yes, music is invasive like that, but it's also immersive, it's expansive, you know, and it goes in all kinds of direction. I mean, you know, I don't sort of listen to Stockhausen, you know, in the way that I might, you know, take a cold shower or sort of try and do 100 press-ups, something like that. It isn't some sort of, like, Spartan sort of aesthetic regimen. It's a joy to me.
Exactly like that. Somebody once described the music of Mertzbau exactly like that. Yeah, it was almost a sort of punishment.
Yeah, you find it punishing, and
didn't sell it to me, I have to say.
Yeah. I mean, and I think, you know, this idea of the music as punitive or hurtful or whatever, I mean, you can't do that. You know, and if that's what people think, people can't really be asked to hurt themselves.
Well, I've nearly raised exactly the same point when we were talking about, you know, people going to the galleries and treating them as a sort of cathedral and going to be somehow edified by standing in the presence of some sort of art. And I go along with that. I mean, especially not necessarily modern conceptual art, but certainly, you know, old Renaissance art or something. What I think I get most out of it is the fact that there's like a connection with a human being that did this thing that was like 600 years ago or something. And there is some sort of something passing between you. And I think if you're not, again, if you're not going in to stand there in the presence and get the arty rays from it, again, what is the point really of...
Oh, yeah, I mean, I think it just depends. I mean, I think that's, yeah, but I mean, that sort of response is fine. I think, you know, for sort of, you know, a visual work like that to sort of work on your imagination and things like that is absolutely fine. But again, yeah, I think there's a distinction between the sort of the many wonderful things you can get out of music and art and the sort of spiritual thing. I mean, it happens the same in music as well. I think that music has the capacity to transport people to places that reality won't. And I think that's one of the great things about, you know, Stockhausen, etc. But I mean, people like Stockhausen himself, you know, he took it himself, perhaps, as far as I'm concerned, rather too seriously, because he took it in the realm of the religious. Sun Ra, who also, like, imagined that he was born on Saturn, and imagined that these kind of cosmic sort of creations represented in some way, or, you know, or signified an actual, you know, a literal sort of life forms on Saturn or whatever, or some sort of great religious other. And a lot of people I know that are into experimental music, unfortunately, always, you know, they tend to be sort of conspiracy theories and loons and people that are into magic with a K, which always, like, sets my teeth on edge and all that kind of nonsense. So, I mean, you know, there's a lot...
They're not going to find any friends.
Yeah, this is it, you know. So in the spirit of this particular show, and I'd have to say that I am a rationalist, there's only one reality. However, you know, I do believe in, like I say, the capacity of music to transport to other places and, you know, work in the imagination. And, you know, to sort of, like, expand the sort of, as it were, the realms of your own aesthetic experience. And, you know, and if there is something kind of nutritious, as it were, almost, you know, I just think that, maybe in terms of political and intellectual sort of broad-mindedness, I mean, I think that you are required a certain broad-mindedness in order to sort of absorb and take in that kind of music. I'm on slightly dodgy ground here, but sometimes people who tend to be kind of inherently quite narrow-minded tend to sort of follow music that has a very sort of narrow, thin sort of, you know, frame of reference.
I was thinking about this on the way in, actually, and I know you had some experience at the NME, and I was thinking, in the 80s, the NME was a music paper, and now it's very much a music paper that just writes about indie rock, really, as far as I can see. I mean, to be fair, I haven't read it for quite a few years. But I remember in the 80s, you used to have Richard Cook would be interviewing the likes of Derek Bailey and Cecil Taylor. And I was like an indie rock kid who would read these interviews and think, this stuff sounds interesting, but didn't know where to hear it. And now it's the other way around. If people want to hear Cecil Taylor, they can hear it very easily, but they're unlikely to read about it.
And again, you know, I mean,
unless they're specifically looking for it.
And again, it so happens that when they were writing about that kind of broad, I mean, that was all very educated for me. Mm. They're writing about a very broad range of music, more experimental. They make very bold choices and what they mean. And that tied in also with a kind of very kind of explicit political outlook. Now, I'm not saying that the enemy is going to be urging anyone to vote David Cameron nowadays or anything like that, but it would certainly not have that kind of sort of political dimension, as well as not pursuing those kinds of, like, you know, people you're talking about. They once had Sun Ra on the cover, you know, like, yeah. That's never something. No, we couldn't. That's ever going to happen now. But I suppose if there is a sort of politics, it's the sort of the politics of marketing and things like that, and just and a lot of the bands, and that's sort of in conjunction with the whole where the whole scene is at the moment, in which. Yeah, you do have these kind of sort of neo-indie bands in which these kind, you know, which, you know, they're sort of almost like conveyor belt of little sort of little brown lumps of essence of 1979 or whatever in skinny trousers.
Despite, you know, the setting off point of the book being about, you know, how avant-garde music is somehow a sort of poor relation or is society sees it as such to art, you give the impression that it's actually at the moment the scene is quite healthy. And I was thinking about this and wondering if the way that we consume music now, the way that all media, it's a lot more fractured, you know, we get things from the internet and people get their information in completely different ways. I wonder if you think that's something that could be a benefit to, you know, the very, very small producers of music that in the way that the avant-garde sort of works.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's a whole other question, really, just the general sort of proliferation and fragmentation of things. And I, you know, I'm one of these believers. I think there's more good stuff going on than there ever has been before, right now. You know, but where there's a dearth is in the middle, you know, mm-hmm. and everything's happening on the peripheries. I don't think it's easy for people to kind of necessarily make a living out of making music. I think these things have to be labours of love for people. There is actually a sort of extraordinary high preponderance, I think, of like stuff out there that is really worth checking out and worth listening to, more than the market can bear, basically, in all kinds of, you know. In,
can we perhaps finish with you telling a couple of people that people should look out for, perhaps?
Well, right now. Do you know, I couldn't even do that. I'm sorry about that, but it's just...
I think that's fair enough.
Yeah.
I will
yeah.
say, though, if you don't know much about experimental music, and for goodness sake, what are you doing listening to Resonance? If you don't, you'll know a lot more if you're listening to Resonance. But a good primer is David's book, which gives a perfect history of the parallel history of experimental music, basically from the 20th century onwards.
We'll see you next week then.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Little Atoms. You can find details of upcoming guests on our website, littleatoms.com. The Little Atoms podcast is available on iTunes. Thanks for listening.